Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you there? Welcome to the podcast. Today, it's a real little bit of a gem. The other day, we spoke to Martin Wolf of the FT, again, one of the greats about Brexit, Britain, where it's likely to go. Second part of that chat is a little bit later on this podcast. And it's really about threats to the world. So we're going very, very big, John. We're doing climate change. We're doing demography. We're doing AI. Threat to democracy of AI and climate change together. And interestingly, one of the points that Martin Wolf is talking about is this massive demographic pressure, which is going to be coming from Africa to Europe.
Yep.
So European population is static and falling. African population is growing rapidly. Unless Africa grows economically and provides opportunity for people, they're going to move.
Of course.
And you and I, see what I did there?
Yeah, I did.
We're in Marseille. And Marseille is going to be the epicenter. Because Marseille, if you speak to French people, they will say, well, it's kind of the capital of the Maghreb. It's capital of North Africa, right?
Yeah.
And it has a real North African feel to it. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you felt that when you were there.
Well, actually, it was a bit diluted last weekend with green.
With the gargle.
The gargle. But with everyone down there, because we were down there for the rugby match, Ireland-France, famous win, and it was mayhem in Marseille. Absolute.
It was mayhem. By the way, I actually avoided John's rollover lunches. John had, I've never met anybody. We've heard of rollovers, like a big night, you roll over into the next day in early houses and all that sort of, but to have like three rollover lunches, which is lunch, dinner.
Oh my God, I'm still not right. We're half a week on and I'm still not right. But actually—
But you're looking particularly fine. I'm going to call you Marcella. Hello, Marcella. Ça va, Marcella?
But speaking of demographics, I'll tell you one thing, and this is a slight aside, but the mayhem in Marseille trying to get into the ground was, like, I love the French, I love France, all the rest, but they cannot organise anything. There was literally, we started going into the ground.
I love this, an Irish person accusing the French of not being able to organise. I mean, we are the least organised people in the world.
Well, I tell you, we were started going into the ground 45 minutes beforehand. There was literally 20,000 people chopped solid
on the
steps outside.
All dying for a pee.
Oh, yes, that's true. Given how the singing started and then it gradually petered out as the people got more and more pissed off. But I didn't get in till after the anthems.
Oh.
45 minutes to walk 20 yards. Unbelievable. But what struck me about it...
As there's something that's on John's mind and he is not prepared to be silent about it.
But you know, the Gilets Jaunes and all that kind of stuff. You know, all these protests, the French love a good old protest.
Yeah.
But if you treat people like shit, the way the gendarmerie do...
The CRS were there. In strength, yeah.
And when you treat people like shit, there's going to be a reaction. And that reaction is generally quite violent.
Yeah.
And I can understand now why people get out onto the streets. I was like, come here.
On the other hand, I kept getting texts from John. And the more he said, oh, we're in, it's really cool. There's a scrum of people. Come and join us. I was like, no, I think I'll go in the other thing.
We had pints and everything for you.
What amazed me, the difference, cultural difference, right, was that inside the stadium, there were a couple of bars, right? And as I arrived in, I was about 15 minutes before the game, right?
Yeah.
So you go to the, there was a five fellas in the queue for a pint, right?
Right.
The French lads are all chatting to each other, the barman. Now, the way an Irish barman is just a milking machine when it comes to giving out pints, right? It's like hundreds of pints across and there's no fuckology, right? These French guys are asking us about the weather and things. I was like, no, just give us a drink. And hurry up, Jean-Claude, get the finger out.
Exactly. There's 50,000 people behind you waiting for a drink.
No, but next week we're going to be talking about Avignon, where I went the day after, which is the old papal city. And there was a Pont d'Avignon, which is a very famous... There's a very famous song that all French school kids learn.
Yeah.
And it, actually, that whole part of the world, I found absolutely fascinating.
Save all that for next week.
Save all that way, because we've got lots coming about 17th century economics, 17th century climate change.
Stuff.
It's
good
really
stuff.
Good stuff. 17th century demographic change. And it's going to be a link to what happened here. There's going to be a link between what happened to the French Huguenots and what happened to Irish Catholics in the 17th century.
Beautiful.
Reflective. All good. But... there's a thing that annoyed me today.
Oh?
RTE.
Oh.
RTE reappointed Deloitte, who were the auditors that missed everything. So, little recap.
They're like the DUP of auditors.
The DUP. Right. So, little recap. We know what happened at RTE. The senior management basically cooked the books.
Yeah.
In effect, right?
Yeah.
And the role of the auditor... is you're paid to make sure you find out who is cooking the books on behalf of the board and on behalf of the taxpayer, right? If you don't find that, you haven't done your job. So usually in the world, there's consequences for that, right?
The
consequences, you don't get the next gig.
Yes.
And RTE, and I read the paper yesterday and it said, RTE reappoint Deloitte despite Deloitte not seeing all the chicanery. Headline should have read, RTE reappoint Deloitte because they didn't see the chicanery, because they're all on the same side.
Yeah,
it's all this cozy cartel. And I think this is what, this is the sort of kind of insiderdom that pisses people off when they see it. They say, let's have consequences.
Well, I read that article too, and it actually, it did remind me of your one-man show, The Outsiders, which was all about that, how there were no consequences for the bankers and all the people who...
And just, the consultants and all that sort of stuff.
Who made a mess of everything, and we're all paying for it, and they just shifted on to their next gig. It was just like musical chairs, really.
Exactly. And you see, what happens is then, so you have a strange situation where RTE is paid by the taxpayer through the license fee. But a part of that license fee goes to pay Deloitte. So Deloitte are in effect working for the taxpayer, but they're both working against the taxpayer because they're both disguising what they're doing with taxpayers' money. It's bizarre stuff, right?
Yeah, and it's blood-boiling stuff.
It may well be the case that Deloitte or whoever was the auditor didn't look the other way, but actually made a mistake.
Yeah.
That's fine. And people make mistakes, right? But there should be consequences. You shouldn't be able to say, well, look, just give us the next gig. And that's the sense that there's no responsibility taken. There's no consequence for your reaction. And we just go on as if nothing happened.
But we spoke about this before.
And
about,
it is the insider outsider thing.
Yeah. And we spoke about this before about, you know, we both work for RTE and I've seen it. There is no consequence for doing a shit job in RTE.
Yeah. You have Deloitte doing a shit job. You're the former chief executive of RTE. Not turning up to explain anything at all. I mean, anything.
Yeah.
But again, it's not just RTE, it's the proximity of big business and big public sector abusing taxpayers' money with impunity and suggesting that, you know what, doesn't really matter. And all the while, this is pissing people off.
Yeah.
And this is the stuff that feeds into elections. This is the first stuff that feeds into votes. And this is the stuff that feeds into us and them and all that sort of stuff. So,
Mark, do you know, just to calm you down.
I know, I'm calm.
I'm going to play you some soothing music.
Oh, yes. Well, it's a very big day in the McWilliams household today because Lucy has a new single just released called Old Ways. She's going to be playing a couple of gigs, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But let's just... John, what you did
there. Isn't that lovely?
Okay, we'll play the whole track on the way out.
Well, it's a humdinger, by the way.
Yeah, no, it is a classic. Let us now go, John, and let us talk about the issues at hand, which are the major threats to the global economy and society.
Yeah.
And let's go back and finish the conversation with Martin Wolf of the FT and get his take on the big five threats to, in effect, global stability over the coming years. It's not really a reassuring listen, I'm going to warn you. It's a serious listen, but it lays things out very clearly. So let's go to London, talk to Martin. Martin Wolf of the FT wrote a piece last week about risks to the global world. I remember you published a book about 10 years ago about shocks. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, shifts.
Shifts and shocks, and basically a way of looking at the world. The world shifts in sort of big cyclical ways, and then those shifts are punctuated by shocks, that these kind of risks to the society and risks to the economy. And it's understanding these two massive tectonic issues gives you a good way to look at the world. And I kind of thought of that when I read the piece there last week. Explain to me, you're talking about the risk to the global economy and consequently global society, geopolitics, politics. Where do we start?
So the way I've actually done three pieces on this theme in the last 2 weeks, two on the world economy and one on globalization more specifically and the future of globalization. I'll try and put them together as quickly as I can. So if we think about where we are, I divide the forces in the factors in the following way. The underlying drivers, which are long-term, pretty predictable. They're not certain, but pretty predictable and will continue to change everything. There were five of them. There are, first and foremost, I think possibly the most important, will demography and the profound demographic changes of our world, which the most important are aging, which you must know all about too in Ireland. And of course, the fact that pretty well all the population growth in the world is occurring in two places, and the most important of which is sub-Saharan Africa, which is exploding in population, the other one being South Asia. That's where population growth is occurring. And in most other parts of the world, we are below replacement level. So that's a huge factor. The second thing I point to is climate. It seems to me absolutely certain that global warming will continue, probably exceed all the limits we are trying to keep us below, but it will certainly continue for the next 10, 20 years, and that's going to be very, very disruptive. The third is technological change, and I think the more I look at it, the more I feel, and I've just spent time talking to one of the experts in AI yesterday, that the artificial intelligence revolution combined with what we already created is going to be absolutely colossal, seismic. Then the fourth is the rise of Asia, the fundamental transformation of the locus of production. China is now far and away the world's largest manufacturing power. It's become a technological rival across the full spectrum. India is really growing pretty rapidly. This is an absolutely fundamental shift of power. The West is still the largest entity, but this is a tremendous seismic shift. And the last is growth itself, that one of the most extraordinary statistics is ever since 1950, there's only been 2 years in which the world economy has shrunk. Every single year it's grown. Wow. And I think it is likely to continue to grow. So those are the five driving factors. And I think on all these, we know more or less where we're going to be 10 to 20 years from now, barring some colossal, a huge pandemic, global thermonuclear war, something like that. Those are the driving forces. Then we have a huge number of obvious risks. We can't assess their probabilities. And this has become very real to us because just in the last 4 years, two of those risks have been realized. The pandemic was a risk that we knew about, and wars. We've had two significant wars, and we got lots more. And there are many, many other possible risks which could materialize, and they're somewhat random, though they're not completely random. Obviously, wars occur in certain circumstances more probably than others. We can deal with them in different ways. But right now, we're living in a world which has been shaped, in addition to the driving forces I've mentioned, by a series of shocks, the most important of the global financial crisis of now about 15 years ago, and the pandemic and these two wars. And the difficulty is we don't know where there are going to be more shocks, because they could be. I could list all these shocks. And we don't know quite how these will unwind. If they do, you know, we don't have more shocks. And if they don't, if they unwind slowly, we could get back to smoother water. But, and then we get to the last thing I list as things people should think about, what I call the underlying fragilities, which will determine how well we can cope with the drivers interacting with possible shocks. And the most important of those are debt, enormously high debt, public and private, across most of the world. The possibility of the shattering of the global trade system. I think I didn't discuss that so cool, but that's clearly a possibility. That's a fragility because we are so internationally integrated. And then there are politics. And the key elements here are domestic politics, the crisis of democracy, the possible election of Trump is a symptom of that, and international politics, the incredibly sensitive relationships between China and the US, which they're trying to manage. So those are the forces that are operating on it. And if you put these things together, you realize what a pervasively uncertain world we live in. I would bet that we will still continue to grow. We will have profound economic changes. But I also would bet we're going to continue to have some very large political upheavals, and these could involve global conflict, and those have huge downsides. So the steady state, if everything calms down, would be towards a more cooperative, growing world in which these crises we've had sort of fade away. And I think that's what the US and China are now working for. But there's a huge number of risks surrounding that. And we've had recent experience of them. And there's no reason to suppose we're at the end of it.
I mean, this is extraordinary stuff. Let's stand back at the big trends, right? Your demographic trends, right? What does it mean for the world where the population of one part of the world, the West, is not replacing, and the population of sub-Saharan Africa is not only replacing itself, but is surging? What does that mean for migration, for economic activity, for innovation, for all these things that come with significant young populations?
I think that, and by the way, I would add to that, because it's very important, is that China is aging more quickly, though it's still younger than we are. And its fertility rate now is basically half of replacement. So its population is set to shrink. So the big areas of the world economy now are suffering from very significant demographic collapses. The US is actually in a relatively good position. Well, what does it mean? I think there are two answers to that, unfortunately. Is one, we don't know, because it's not clear the sub-Saharan Africans will be able to exploit their fertility, their population dividend, as it's sometimes called, the dividend of having lots and lots of young people. Yeah. As the birth rate continues to decline, which it will. The Indians have had this opportunity for a long time, but they've never really exploited it, and they still have big unemployment problems as a result. So will this accelerate the growth of sub-Saharan Africa on its own? I would guess not. There's an opportunity there, but exploiting that opportunity with these huge baby booms is very difficult. You have to educate people. You have to create economic system in which productive activity is encouraged and successful. And unfortunately, right at the moment, this is not going very well. In fact, the last 10 years or so for sub-Saharan Africa have been really poor. I won't go into that in more detail. So If that continues, which I think is the most likely outcome, and if we assume that climate will get worse too, there is a must be a high probability that the migration problems we've had, mostly across the Mediterranean, will get worse, possibly much worse. And my prediction, therefore, with great sadness, is that the politics of immigration and managing the politics of immigration will become an even more dominant feature of our politics than they already are. And I think that, and that brings us back to other discussions we've had, that means that the right-wing populists are going to have fuel for their campaigns. And if you add into that the probability that developing countries with these demographics will also, and economics, will have political instability and even civil war, this becomes even more certain. So I regard that as pretty well the most obvious prediction about the future, is that the migration problem will get worse.
So let's just take that. The migration problem gets worse. And then you look at the Western societies. Let's talk about AI. I mean, AI has been compared to, we've done it in this podcast, Gutenberg, the printing press, that type of revolutionary change that really shifted societies in the 16th century and 17th century. We kind of forget, you know, it led to the Reformation. The Reformation led to the 30 Years' War. I mean, this was not a nice time to be European by any stretch of the imagination. You know, that type of global pressure, immigration, flows, migration, what does AI do to the broad middle class in the reasonably comfortable West over the course of the next while? I mean, where does it push jobs that were reasonably secure in the past? It definitely will create new jobs, but it's that transition from the old to the new, which is the fragile part.
Yes, I think that the second huge question, I would stress that I have no expertise in this, so I just based on a priori thinking and talking to a few very, very smart people who tend to disagree on these things. But one way we can think about this, it's clearly there's no consensus on this yet. But there seems to me a very, very good chance that these systems, as they evolve, will be able to do a very large proportion of the, what you might call, the information processing and communication jobs of our societies. And basically, those are the most lucrative. And they're the ones that define our social hierarchies. If you think about it, for a very long time, the dominant elements in our social hierarchies were the top bureaucrats and the soldiers, the knights. The Brahmins and the warriors. But now, if you look at the numbers, we really have very few warriors and we have lots of Brahmins. And that's why almost half of our population goes to universities and they all expect Brahmin jobs. And that is exactly what AI is going for, because these machines can absorb and process information and spew it out reliably, without mistakes, well, more or less reliably, I'll leave aside the hallucinations, with a speed and accuracy that no human being can match. And it's unlockable that it's going to demolish huge proportions of our current jobs. I don't see why it is necessarily the case that all these jobs will be replaced any more than the advances of productivity in manufacturing led to the replacement of the lost jobs with new jobs in manufacturing. They didn't. They led to the replacement with a lot of casual work, which most of which was not very satisfactory. You know, people on bicycles delivering packages for Amazon and people in warehouses and so forth. So seems to me that what AI is going for is the thing that we would consider in our society, and historically we might have considered, as the core characteristic of human beings, namely their ability to think. And if that's right, it might indeed be the most revolutionary moment in our economics. So my only column on this subject, which I wrote almost a year ago, which I still think is probably right. We basically made two points about the AI revolution. It started by pointing out what's happened to the horse as an economic input in the last 140 years. And remember, the horse was a really important economic input in 1880. That was the main vehicle and the main source of transport. And it's gone. Now it's just entertainment. Well, why shouldn't that happen to human beings? I don't think there's any logical reason why that couldn't. Economists always say, well, it never has so far. Well, you know, that's the famous, gives you the famous joke about the turkey who comments to his friends in early December about how kind and gentle the farmers are who feed them so wonderfully. And, well, we know what happens to the turkey. So the one possibility is, I think, that this could be a decisive shift. And so, that, as I joke, the next Martian will be a computer. And the other thing that I'm absolutely convinced of is that we have no idea how to regulate this and no capacity to do so. So I do believe we are on the cusp of one of the really great technological revolutions, as Hugh indicated, and at least as big as the internet, probably more so. And that fits with the technological revolution, which I've already mentioned, which is ongoing and has to do with extraordinary progress in our processing power. Moore's law and the effects of Moore's law continues to operate. And it, over now 60 years, it's dramatic. And again, the ultimate consequence for human society, its functioning is not clear, but I do wonder whether our current political arrangements will survive in this sort of world.
Martin Wolf, we could talk all day, but there's so much food for thought there. John and I are going to come back. We've got to digest all this when we come back in. No, but it's funny. Do you remember Keynes was saying years ago that eventually we'll all be chilling out and doing the things we want to do?
Yeah.
Was he right?
Well, if we are sensible, we will socialize. I mean, this is socialism. We will have to socialize these means of production. We cannot allow 10 or 5 or 10 firms to monopolize this and own all the profits, and their owners own all the profits, because then we'll live in the most feudal society imaginable with everybody else. What will they do? So we'll have to socialize these means of production and share out the goodies. But there's a very big but. Let's suppose we do that. We're all live wonderful, sybaritic, idle lives with machines do everything. Do you think that human beings can really be satisfied en masse with a life in which what they do is irrelevant to anybody else's happiness or welfare in any obvious economic way? It is a transformation. You know, it's moving out of scarcity in a world in which everybody lives in lotus land. If we do it well. If we do it badly, everybody gets redundant and most go onto the scrappy. But if we do it well, we live in lotus land, if that's right, in this high productive world. And I don't think human beings are very good at coping with that. Everything I see indicates we need the meaning in our lives of work. It's part of what we've evolved to do. And we need to think that work, whatever it is valuable. And I don't know how we're going to do that.
Martin, we will leave it there on that philosophical point. But it is true, the lotus eaters, what happened to them? Wasn't the best way to end. Martin, that was great. Really good stuff. Fantastic stuff. Thank you so much for your time, and we will talk to you very soon.
I hope so. It's been an immense pleasure to talk to you again, David.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Our friend Martin is at it again.
What's he at, John?
Sybaritic Idle Lives.
Ah, yes.
That man has
studied the classics. Yes. That man has studied the classics. Okay, so last week we had, or 2 days ago, we had Sui Generis, yes, and Sui Generosity. And this week we will talk about the substance of what Martin was saying about, you know, the economics. But yes, the sybaritic life.
It's a new word for me, you see.
Which is the life of the lotus eater. And yes, the lotus eaters, John, were people who lived on an island in Greece. And if you read...
I thought they were a band from the 80s.
They were a band from the 80s with big, big hair.
Yes.
First picture of you?
It's the first picture of summer.
He always hits the notes. He always holds those notes. But the lotus eaters, John, Lotus eaters, the Odyssey, book by Homer, of which our good friend Mr. Joyce based the Ulysses idea on, right? So you have Odysseus going around trying to find home.
Yeah.
And he's mooching around all around the Aegean. And one of the islands he stumbles across is the lotus eaters. And the lotus eaters are fellas who are eating from the lotus tree. And the fruit of the lotus tree, you'd really like this, it's right up your alley, is a narcotic, right?
Nice.
So they get off their box. So the lotus eaters are, in effect, stoned. You know, when people think that smoking and, you know, drugs are new, they're not. Humans have been doing shit for years, right?
Absolutely.
So that's the lotus eaters.
So right? The whole thing about Jesus and walking on water, all the lads were baked off their nuts. It was a mirage.
Exactly. And the water.
Dude, man.
The Big Lebowski as Jesus, right? Okay. So the Greek Empire, this is all about Greeks. The Greek Empire was not an empire like the Persian Empire. Mm. So the Persian Empire was a massive, and the Egyptian Empire, these were massive agricultural empires where the boss men took over and subjugated huge tracts of land. They then forced these people to work for them. They generated grain surpluses, and that's how they stayed in power.
Yeah.
The Greeks changed this completely, which is why Greek culture is so different to everything else. And the Greeks had a massive empire, but it was never based on territorial conquest. It was always based on Greek trading cities all around the Mediterranean, the Black Sea, and the Aegean.
Mm.
Now, our friend Plato described this beautifully as describing the cities as being like frogs looking into a pond, right? So you can imagine frogs looking into a pond, the pond being the Mediterranean, the Aegean, and the Black Sea, which is a lovely, lovely way of describing Greek culture. And they were brought together by a combination of philosophy, ideology in terms of Greek civilization, and money.
Mm.
Money was the big thing. The drachma had them all together. And they were commercial cities and very, 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 very sophisticated places, right? Because Greek culture is so different to everything else. But the place that you and I should have lived was Sybaris, right?
Which is
basically on the boot of Italy, right beside Sicily.
Yes.
Right? And these people were so wealthy that they just became indulgent, this kind of hung around.
Terrific.
This was the biggest Greek city in Italy. And imagine there were many Greek cities in Italy. Rome, again, of course.
Syracuse. Syracuse
being the big one. And who was from Syracuse? Archimedes.
Ah, okay.
Archimedes.
Yes,
and we're going to be talking about mathematics.
Right.
And the economics of mathematics with Colm O'Regan next week.
Right.
But the Sybaritic lifestyle is basically you're hanging out, indulging, because it was so rich that these guys could just chill and relax and do nothing.
Yeah.
That's what Martin was talking about. But let's get back to the economics.
So what he was talking about was AI.
Yes.
And allowing us to have that kind of lifestyle. Actually, one of the things he did say, he talked about, you know, AI is going to take over and it will change society in the same way as the horse was a really important part of society and production. It was a production cost. Ooh, that sounded good. But then he said, but horses became entertainment eventually.
Yeah.
And so he was saying that humans are going to become entertainment. And I was thinking, entertainment for whom? Are we going to be dancing for computers?
We are going to be doing podcasts for computers, right? We are going to. No, but I mean, his point is a really good one, which is that we are talking about a massive technological shift. Maybe like, for example, we talked about the printing press, but maybe even more like something like the introduction of electricity.
Yeah.
So electricity changed the whole world. You know, Thomas Edison was sitting around going, oh, this light bulb, this is an interesting thing, right? And of course, Nikola Tesla.
Of course,
of which
yeah,
the Tesla's yeah. mentioned after, yeah. named after. And the Croats say he's Croat. I love that. The Croats say he's Croat and the Serbs say he's Serb. Only in former Yugoslavia. But, you know, that changed the world. It changed yeah. how we lived, yeah. it changed how we worked, all that sort of stuff. And of course, it did for the horse. What did for the horse was rubber and the combustion engine.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think it was it Henry Ford was asked if people had been asked in 1900 what they wanted for transport, they would have said faster horses.
Exactly.
And what happened was cars and the yeah. horse is gone. So what he's saying yeah. is that a huge amount of our work, our intellectual work, our brain power work, etc., could well be done by AI in the future.
Mm.
So then what happens, people, right? Do we have the sybaritic lifestyle, etc.? But what he means, and he goes back to, and I remember talking about Keynes at the end. Keynes said the same thing is going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? That basically people will become redundant in terms of what we used to do.
Mm.
And what Martin is saying, I think, is that over the last 2,000 years, but particularly over the last 300 years, changes in technologies have always led to people like the Luddites in England saying, you know, oh my God, if we embrace this technology, our jobs will be gone and we will never do anything else.
Yeah.
But what we actually find has happened, particularly when the internet came, was people said, oh my God, the internet's going to wipe out so many jobs. In actual fact, an entire internet economy emerged.
Yeah.
Of which we're part of it. I mean, podcasting is part of the internet economy.
Yes, indeed. But that doesn't worry me at all, what it turns into. It's the transition
is
the tricky bit.
We're in it now.
Yes, we are in it now. But he did also talk about that society needs to become more socialist,
yeah.
which I thought was really curious, particularly at a time when we were talking about Millie and the rise of libertarianism.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that what you always see is these sort of pendulum swings. So let's say you get a complete shock to the system, right? Not just like AI, but I mean, I think we spoke about the Argentinians being traumatized, a traumatized race after 50 years of economic underperformance. And their transition that you speak about has been going on for years. So they've been transitioning from a rich to a poor society. This
yeah.
is very unusual because most societies in this growth era transition from poor to rich.
Mm.
And they have gone for libertarianism that can say, look, we've seen all that. So the result of the transition has been libertarianism for them.
Mm.
But what Martin Wolf is saying is that the long-term implications of AI is that unless we want to turn back into a feudal society, and I think about the word feudal, feudal betokens ideas of the early Middle Ages, right?
Mm.
And you have yeah. basically an entirely dependent agricultural class, which is genuflecting to the church and the squires, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The kings, right? He's saying, unless we want to go there, we need to socialize the gains from AI. That means we need to go back to Roosevelt, not FDR Roosevelt, but we need to go back to Teddy Roosevelt, who basically broke up all these big companies.
Yes.
Right? And he said, you're too big. Those oil companies, those rail companies, you're too big. We're going to break you up. That has to happen with AI companies. That has to happen. Because if we don't socialize, what is in effect human intelligence? This is what, if we privatize collective human intelligence, we will destroy democracy. We will destroy the social contract. And we will have Mark Zuckerbergs of this world. Those sort of people. You know what I found very interesting about Mark Zuckerberg? He's the person that everyone says, oh, he's Mr. Progress, right? Do you know what he's just done? He's just bought himself an island in Hawaii, which is a bet on Armageddon. That really freaks me out.
Right.
If the guy who actually knows most about progress in the world is actually in his personal life buying himself a massive,
He's a doomsday prepper.
He's a doomsday prepper. He's an Armageddonist.
It's filled it full of tins of beans.
Tins of beans. But if you think about it, the guys who are most, like your man Peter Thiel and all those big tech people, those guys who are most invested in progress and the future and telling us it's all going to be great are buying themselves hideaways all over the world, just in case it all goes wrong, which is really terrifying.
But these are also the guys who are promoting this whole philosophy of EAC.
And libertarianism.
Effective accelerationism, which is all about just let AI and technology loose, with no restrictions, no nothing. And if it upends society, so be it.
Because they have their gaff in Hawaii. That's why we end with Marx. We end with Marx, right? Marx talked about owning the commanding heights of the economy. He talked about the key thing was owning the means of production. Mm. That's the basis of Das Kapital, right? That's the actual whole thing.
Yeah.
And here we have Martin Wolf, the main columnist of the Financial Times, that we might not suggest would be Marxist in their DNA. Yes. John Davis, that we might not suggest is Marxist in their DNA, right? But everyone moving to this idea that, hold on a second, it's not necessarily we go back to the Communist Manifesto in 1848, but what we realize is that we have to own the means of production. And if the means of production are AI, and if we allow a tiny amount of feudal techno overlords to own that, we will destroy society. So, John, this is what's at stake, right? It's not just about share prices of AI companies. It's not just about a technology that might change the world. It's actually about who owns the world. And that's a pretty big question to answer. Just before we go, we're going to play out with Lucy's new track, which is the third track on a forthcoming EP, which is out in the end of March. And to coincide with that, she has two gigs, which we may well go to. Just coming up to Easter weekend, Wednesday, she's playing the 27th of March in London, Dalston.
Nice.
Neck of the woods that you and I don't particularly know.
Yes.
But I know your daughter lives over there, in that neck of the woods.
Yep. She hangs out there.
Lucy's playing in the London Servant Jazz Quarter. Who doesn't want to play there, right? And then the following night, March 28th, Thursday night, she is playing in Grand Social in Dublin to coincide with this new EP. So maybe let's play out with a little bit of music. But the point about AI, John, what we were making there is that you still cannot take away what I describe as the placenta of human creativity, which is the human mind. Musicians, artists, poets, writers, all these creatives will still be in demand because they are unique and they can't be just replicated.
So let's be generous.
Sybaritic. Lotus Eaters. Let's have a Lotus Eater play out with Lucy's new track.
Summertime in Dublin, you show me where the sun lived, made a world no one could see. The changing of the seasons, drowning. Now you can see me as your baby. Now it's just too late. I'm gonna close my eyes and I don't mind when you walk on by. You took my time, you made me cry. And now it's night.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.